From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells. Our next guest is David Quammen, who wrote in the opening paragraph of his 2012 book Spillover, and I quote, "The next big and murderous human pandemic, the one that kills us in millions, will be caused by a new disease, new to humans anyway. The bug that will be responsible will be strange, unfamiliar, but it won't come from outer space. Odds are the killer pathogen, most likely a virus, will spill over into humans from a non-human animal." Quotation closed. David Quammen, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, John. Hi, Lynn. It's good to be back with you again.
Oh, it's great to have you back. We really enjoyed our conversation back in September of 2018 of The Tangled Tree. Fascinating. And I would urge our listeners, if you didn't hear that, go to kpcw.org and just do a search under The Tangled Tree, and you'll hear that podcast. You also said, in addition to what I just said in the intro, that it'll probably be caused by a virus. It's possibly a bat that in some situation of close disruptive contact between humans and wild animals, such as in or around a wet market, say, for an example, in China. I'm sorry to say it, but man, it sounds like you really nailed this one, huh?
Yeah, I've had friends ask me, what does it feel like to be prescient? And I have said, I'd rather be wrong. But of course, it's not my prescience. It's the scientists that I talked to 10 years ago when I was researching Spillover. They told me in bits and pieces what to expect when I asked them, will there be a next big one? And they said, yes, there will be. And then they outlined a series of likelihoods, like a virus from a wild animal, very possibly a bat, very possibly either an influenza or a coronavirus, and very possibly somehow connected with a wet market. So there it was. When I heard the word coronavirus in early, mid-January, I had a shudder of awareness that, okay, this could be it. This could be the big one.
Yeah. In 1970, 50 years ago, the world population was 3.6 billion people. Currently, 50 years later, 2020, 7.8 billion, and it's estimated that we'll get to 9.4 billion in the next 50 years by 2070. David, what is the relationship between population growth and potential animal spillover like Ebola and COVID-19?
Yeah, that's a really good and important question. First of all, wild animals carry viruses. We have many, many species of wild animals, particularly in our great diverse ecosystems. They all carry viruses, in many cases unique viruses. We don't know how many hundreds of thousands or millions of viruses exist in the wild animals of this planet. Most of those are potentially harmless to humans. Some are potentially dangerous to humans. Humans have always been coming in contact with wild animals. We were hunter-gatherers. We were killing wild animals to eat ever since we've been a species, 200,000 years or so. But what's different now is scale, the scale of the human population, the scale of the interactions with wild ecosystems and the wild animals that live in them, the scale of the disruption that we cause, and our interconnectedness. Not just 7.8 billion of us, as you say, and that's important, but 7.8 billion who are all essentially within a 16-hour plane ride of one another. Spillovers are more likely to happen because there's more disruption, and each spillover, that's the moment when a new pathogen, say a virus, passes from its non-human animal host into a human, each spillover is more likely to cause not just a local outbreak, but an epidemic or a pandemic, because once a new virus gets into humans and finds that it can replicate and transmit from human to human, then, as I said, it can spread around the world in you know, in less than a day, which is what happened with SARS-1, but we stopped it, and what has now happened with SARS-2.
David, would you talk about the process of spillover? I mean, we are all connected here in the animal kingdom, but is there, you know, what makes the spillover transpire?
Well, we come in contact, as I said, with wild animals and the viruses that they carry. These viruses are not... they don't have purpose. They don't have goals. They're not looking to infect humans. They don't wish us harm. Mm-hmm. They follow basic Darwinian principles of shaped by natural selection. They have an inherent tendency to replicate themselves as much as possible and extend themselves in space and time. So if one gets into a human and finds that it can replicate and finds that it can spread from one human to another, spreading itself a little bit in space, then it has this opportunity, 7.8 billion individuals of this new host that it has gotten into. And if we're very unlucky and the virus is very lucky, it happens to be well enough adapted before it gets into us to do that, to replicate and to transmit, or it slowly adapts to be able to replicate better, more abundantly, and to spread, transmit more easily and more effectively. And with this one, new virus, we don't know whether it was pre-adapted to succeed in us so well, or whether there was a period of time when it was either in humans or in another animal, something besides bats, during which it acquired the adaptations that allow it to be so effective now.
Mm.
That's one of the big mysteries that remains.
Right. If you're just joining us, our guest is David Quammen. He's talking about his book, Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic. It was written in 2012. Obviously very applicable today and not surprising at all to you, David. But what has surprised you about the coronavirus?
I'd say two things, Lynn. First of all, the fact that it has this capacity for cryptic transmission, silent spread, meaning that people who feel no symptoms, who have no idea that they are infected and are walking around in public, that they can be shedding virus. That was not true of SARS-1 in 2003, and that's one of the reasons we were able to contain it. The addition of that capacity is the nightmare scenario, added to what we already knew about dangerous coronaviruses. Second thing that surprised me is how unprepared we were to deal with this, particularly the U.S., but countries, other countries too. The fact that we had no really effective diagnostic capacity at the beginning. We didn't have test kits that worked. We didn't have enough test kits. In the U.S., we didn't have pandemic preparedness plans. We had had some pandemic preparedness capacity at the National Security Council. There was a directorate devoted to this, but that directorate had been closed down during the current administration. There were some other plans and efforts that were closed down by the current administration. So we had lost most of whatever pandemic preparedness we had, and we were just caught flat-footed. And so it has just been a disaster in this country, but a disaster in a number of other countries, too, for reasons that are still unclear. This is a very subtle, sneaky, nefarious, complex virus, and we're only beginning to learn how it has succeeded in doing such a job on us.
I want to mention that Dr. John Ziegler, a friend of mine, gave me a call several weeks ago. He was reading Spillover, and he said, "You got to get this book." I mean, he thought it was a game changer. So I want to tell our listeners, if you have show ideas, please contact us at coolscience@kpcw.org. We'd love to get your story ideas. And thank you again, Dr. Ziegler.
Thank you, Dr. Ziegler.
Yeah, he's a great guy, great guy. And so there are all these people on TV and radio that are talking about COVID-19, and some of the stuff that they talk about is probably evidence-based and true. I don't know what percentage, but how can our listeners, how can Lynn and I get through some of the rhetoric and find information that's credible. Do you have any advice for us?
Well, that's a really important problem that we all face, because there is just such an explosion of information. It's like the Big Bang. It's just exploding out in all directions. And so all of us, science writers like me, journalists, doctors, people who are, regular citizens doing none of those particular niche jobs, have this problem of how do you know? You hear a report. There's a new report that you might be able to get infected multiple times by COVID-19. But there's another report now that people who have survived COVID-19 have strong antibodies. There's another report that it came from bats. No, there's another report that it came from pangolins. No, it came from snakes. How do you sort all these things? And my answer is, first of all, people when they see a report that comes up on their computer from some search engine or from some news outlet, the thing to ask first is, well, whose report? Where does it come from? What is the report based on? Is there a published scientific article on which this particular reporter has based this story? And if so, move through this news story quickly and get to the scientific article. Now, not everybody is going to want to do that or is going to be able to wade through the jargon of a scientific journal paper. That's what I do for a living, wade through the jargon of scientific journal papers. But still, the thing to do is ask, where does this report come from, based on what kind of science, how many individuals were tested to produce this particular result? Their antibodies are weak and they disappear. Was that based on 1,000 individuals who have been studied, or is that based on 12 individuals who've been studied? We need to ask questions like that. We need to be critical thinkers, even if we're not experts on this. We need to ask, who is saying this based on what kind of solid or delusive evidence or pseudo-evidence? Go to the sources.
Well, I think that's great advice. And with all the open questions that we do have, what one question would you like to have answered that has not been answered yet about this virus?
Well, for me in particular, it's what I've already mentioned. It's the question of the origin. Where did this come from? It's very similar to a bat virus, but not similar enough to have come directly from the bat virus that we know into humans. There's a gap of about 4% in terms of its genome. That 4% could be decades of evolutionary divergence. So what's in the gap? What is the missing link for this virus? And that's important because it helps us understand how to deal with this virus, possibly how to best design a vaccine or therapeutic treatments, but also how to defend against another spillover of this. And then the other question that is unanswered to me so far is why are we so unprepared? Why are we not able to have a national plan for dealing with this virus, coordinating the states, coordinating the questions of schools, and cooperating with other nations? Because this thing, one scientist said to me, in this day and age, a disease somewhere is a disease everywhere. A new virus in humans somewhere is going to be a new virus everywhere. So we need to be globally cooperative and nationally well-organized. And for some reason, none of that has happened so far.
Boy. It is scary, and as it really hits home as we hear more and more the countries that will not allow Americans to come inside their borders. Yeah. David, are you still in Bozeman?
I am in Bozeman, yep.
It always amazes us when we talk to a scientist from Bozeman. You have the Adventure Scientist group up there as well.
Yeah, Greg Trenish, yeah.
And there's such a scientific community in Bozeman. Is it it's just such a nice place. Once you maybe go to college there, you want to stay, or what's the deal?
Well, Bozeman is, it's an interesting place. I don't want to advertise for it, but
oh, we already know about it.
Yeah. Okay. And I also, a disclaimer, I'm not a scientist. I am a science writer. I follow science and scientists for a living, but there are some wonderful scientists here. Some of them are my pals. It's a small town. Jack Horner, the great dinosaur paleontologist, lived here for a long time. That's how I got to know him. There are also very active people, adventurers, mountain climbers. You know, Conrad Anker, the great world-class Himalayan climber, is a pal of mine that lives three blocks away. It's an interesting town. It's not for everybody. You have to like long winters and lots of snow, but you guys know about that in Park City.
Oh, yeah.
That's not for everybody, but boy, if you like it, you really like it. And it's a good place to come home to if you've been off doing the work of, you know, climbing through caves in southern China looking for bats carrying dangerous viruses, or slumping across the Congo rainforest. That's what I do when I'm researching my books and articles, and I love coming back to Bozeman, where the air is cool and dry, and it's not very crowded, and the snow is deep from Halloween to Easter.
Yes. And you all have a lot more rivers up there in Montana than we have in Utah here. But and that was going to be my next question about, you know, being in Bozeman and then going off to all corners of the world to research, especially the book Spillover. And I wanted to ask you about something I didn't know about the pandemic strain of HIV. I have heard before that it was spillover from a chimpanzee into a human in the southeastern corner of Cameroon. What I didn't know was that could have been as far back as 1908. Is that correct?
That is correct, give or take a margin of error. Yes, it's very different from what people think they know about the origins of the AIDS pandemic. But when I was researching spillover, I came across work by two scientists and their colleagues, Beatrice Hahn, who showed with strong, strong molecular evidence that the spillover from one chimp to one human had indeed occurred, as you said, in the southeastern corner of Cameroon. So, parenthetically, I went to the southeastern corner of Cameroon while I was researching the book to look, see what it looked like now. And a scientist named Michael Warraby, a Canadian now at the University of Arizona, who determined also with good molecular work on samples taken from humans, comparing them to the chimpanzee virus, and he determined that that there was essentially almost 100 years of evolutionary divergence between the closest chimp virus and the earliest known human versions of HIV-1 group M, which is the pandemic strain. So he put it back to 1908, give or take a margin of error. And at that point, the virus got into its first human, the real patient zero, and then very slowly transmitted from one person to another, moving down the river systems, probably, out of southeastern Cameroon to the big cities of the Congo River, Brazzaville and what was then Leopoldville, capital of the Belgian Congo. And it spread and spread and spread slowly but with increasing facility in those cities, and then eventually exploded probably out of Leopoldville after it became Kinshasa in the independent Congo, got from there to Haiti, and got from Haiti to the U.S., and then onward to the world.
Wow. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with David Quammen, who wrote the 2012 book Spillover. We also spoke with him in September 2018 about The Tangled Tree, that book, which is, among other things, about horizontal gene transfer. Again, listeners, go to kpcw.org and just do a search on The Tangled Tree, and you'll be able to get that conversation that we had with David back then. And there's something else going on. It was right before or right during the COVID outbreak, and that was that you were working on something called cancer as an evolutionary phenomenon. Can you tell us what that is and what your book's going to be about?
Yes. And I'll say a little bit more about that. I was working on that, you're right. I was about a year into a book on cancer as an evolutionary phenomenon. And what I mean by that is the fact that some scientists have recognized that that a tumor, a cancerous tumor, which is a population of cells, obeys also the laws of evolution by natural selection, Darwinian evolution. And that has serious implications for how cancer perhaps can be treated in the future, understanding that tumor cells are competing against one another and they have genetic variation and it's the survival of the fittest. So if you hit a tumor with chemotherapy, for instance, you may kill 99% of the cells, but the 1% that survive will be the ones that are most capable of resisting that chemotherapy in the future. It's just like hitting a field of grasshoppers with a pesticide. You kill 99% and next year you have a super grasshoppers. So this is an insight that I came across 15 years ago and did a piece on for Harper's Magazine, and I've wanted to get back to it for a book project ever since. I started a year ago, as I said, with a contract for Simon & Schuster, from Simon & Schuster, the publisher. And then I was in Tasmania researching this book in February when COVID-19 exploded. I came home and wrote a few short pieces on it. I had written a New York Times op-ed. I wrote a piece for The New Yorker on it. And then Simon & Schuster said to me, would you please push that cancer and evolution book to the back of your desk very gently and do a book on COVID-19 for us? My first reaction was, there's going to be 100, 200 books on COVID-19. I like to work on things that other people are not writing books about. But in this case, it seemed to me a responsibility as much as an opportunity to do my best to write a book about COVID-19 that will be valuable and somehow unique. So that's what I'm working on now.
Yeah. David, I wanted to ask you, because we touched on this earlier, we've all heard conflicting information on whether antibodies, but that they are produced, but do they last? Do they stay in the person's body that has mm-hmm. has had COVID-19? What is your current thinking on that?
Well, my current thinking is that that's a really important question on which science right now is divided. Just in about the last 3 days, I've read scientific papers that say, that say, yes, it's true that antibodies are produced in abundance and they will be helpful over a long period of time, but other studies saying, no, there's evidence that antibodies might only last 2 or 3 months. 6 months at most, and that if we did have a vaccine, people would have to get booster shots every few months, and it might not be good after a year or two. So this is very provisional ground, very uncertain ground. Science is grappling with that, and different scientists are coming up with different answers. But it has huge implications as to whether a vaccine will be very helpful in getting us past the worst of this or not. I'm inclined still to be hopeful that a vaccine will be very helpful, but there are these studies that are saying, don't count on lasting immunity either from having survived a bout of COVID-19 or from having been vaccinated. Something really, really important to watch.
And of course, it also plays in people talking about herd immunity. If the antibodies wear off over some period of time, you may not be able to achieve herd immunity.
That's absolutely right. The idea of herd immunity depends on a particular equation that the disease scientists use that has three variables: susceptible people in a population, infected people, and recovered people. And if people who have recovered from a bout of the disease are susceptible again 6 months later, then you've, instead of having an equation that produces herd immunity, you've got just a big pinwheel of reinfection.
Wow. So much that we don't know, so much we're learning on a daily basis. It makes me feel like this pandemic is somehow unique in that so much changes so rapidly. The knowledge, the research, what we can really count on. It's really in a state of flux, constant flux.
It is, absolutely, Lynn. It's unique because it's been a long time since we humans have been through a pandemic, anything like this, I suppose the 1918 influenza pandemic. And at that point, we had 2 billion people on the planet. Now we have almost 8 billion, so our population has quadrupled. The speed of travel has increased, and the speed of the production and the dissemination of information has increased, it seems, almost infinitely. So there's much more chatter about this, and that is confusing as well as helpful. And the thing is spreading so quickly, and the information is spreading so quickly. We are in a uniquely challenging situation, but this is not necessarily going to be the last of these. It's the first of the new form of pandemic, but we can't assume that it's the last of the new form of pandemic. And yet we have great science, great scientists. We have brilliant minds. I don't want to be completely gloomy with you today because I'm a basically hopeful person.
And we know that
about you.
We're going
to get through this. I think we're going to get through this at great cost, but we are. Right. I don't believe in despair. I believe in persistence and hope. And there's a lot to base that persistence and hope on.
David, we're almost out of time. We have to wrap up. I'm sorry to interrupt you. David Quammen has written The Song of the Dodo, The Reluctant Mr. Darwin, The Tangled Tree, and of course, Spillover that we're speaking about. We hope you'll come back and join us again.
Thanks so much, David.
You're both welcome. I'd love to come back. Nice to talk with you both.
Thank you,
David.
Have
a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye. Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you missed part of the show or you want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org under the Shows tab.
We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows wherever you find your podcasts, so you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name.
So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio and take us with you on your next road trip or commute. We'll be right back.